from your North Carolina reading service. We present for our audience of blind and print impaired listeners, Indie Week. And our issue today is dated May 19th, 2021. And a quick acknowledgement of our musicians for today's theme music. They are the duo Flora the Fiddler and Pianner Plunkin' Paul Pulaski. And we thank them, and off they go into the green room. And this journal is published on Wednesdays. And since between the time this went to print and today's taping, which is on a Thursday, there have been a new development, which some of you may already be aware. And there is a story about it on the Indie Week online, which I will read. And it was first published in North Carolina Policy Watch. UNC Chapel Hill faculty members demand Hannah Jones be appointed to a tenured position. They released a statement on Wednesday demanding the university's Board of Trustees grant tenure to the acclaimed journalist Nicole Hannah Jones. As Policy Watch reported Wednesday, she was approved for tenure as a Knight Chair in Race and Investigative Journalism by the Faculty Tenure Committee. The school's Board of Trustees did not take action to approve that decision. Instead, Hannah Jones was offered a 5-year contract with the school in what Board of Trustee members described to Policy Watch as a, quote, workaround to avoid the political controversy around her appointment and the necessity of the board to sign off on it. That statement from the faculty says, "We demand explanations from the university's leadership at all levels." And it was signed by more than 24 Hussman faculty members. Nicole Hannah Jones does necessary and transformative work on America's racial history, the national politicization of new universities, journalism, and the social sciences undermines the integrity of and academic freedom within the whole University of North Carolina system. In a Wednesday interview, UNC Board of Trustees Chairman Richard Stevens said the question of Hannah Jones' tenure never came to the board for an official vote. He told Policy Watch, "That part of your story was wrong." He didn't initially respond to a request from Policy Watch on the issue this week, but spoke to the issue before the Wednesday Board of Trustees committee meetings. The trustees members who spoke to Policy Watch did not say the board had voted down her tenure, but that a workaround had been reached to prevent the issue from coming to a vote on the board in the first place. It's not uncommon for board members to have informal conversations with each other and with university officials about matters before they come to a board vote, these members said, with UNC Chapel Hill Chancellor Kevin Guskiewicz and board members aware of the volatility of the question. They said it was deemed best not to bring the issue to an official vote. In a Sunday message to the Hussman faculty, Dean Susan King described the chain of events. "Nicole will join us July 1 as a fixed-term professor of the practice, with the option of being reviewed for tenure within 5 years," King wrote. "When her case was presented, the Board of Trustees did not act on tenure, and she was offered a 5-year fixed-term contract. The Board of Trustees has the authority to approve all tenured lifetime appointments," King wrote. "I was told the board was worried about a non-academic entering the university with this designation." Stephen said he could not say whether the board would have supported tenure for Hannah Jones because the issue never came before them. With her now under a 5-year contract, Stephen said, he didn't anticipate the board taking up the matter unless it is officially brought to a vote at some future date. Representatives from University Relations said Guskiewicz would not answer questions on the issue Wednesday, but would take questions during the media availability, scheduled for after today's Thursday's full Board of Trustees meeting. The faculty statement said the failure to offer Hannah Jones tenure with her appointment as a Knight Chair unfairly moves the goalposts and violates long-standing norms and established processes relating to tenure and promotion at UNC Chapel Hill. The letter also points out the preceding 2 Knight Chairs at UNC immediately received tenure upon their appointment. Quote, the failure to tenure Hannah Jones is especially disappointing given that just last year, the university's Board of Trustees unanimously endorsed Carolina Next Innovations for Public Good, UNC Chapel Hill's strategic plan, the faculty wrote. The plan calls on the university to, quote, prioritize diversity, equity, and inclusion in teaching, research, and service, and in hiring, evaluation, retention, and promotion of underrepresented faculty and staff. We call on the university's leadership to reaffirm its commitment to the university, its faculty, and time-honored norms and procedures, and its endorsed values of diversity, equity, and inclusion, the statement said. The university must tenure Nicole Hannah-Jones as the Knight Chair in Race and Investigative Journalism. Next, two columns. One is an op-ed by Jennifer Holt. These two columns are related to law enforcement practices in the state. Better practices. The town of Fuquay-Varina should bring back the committee that was tasked with evaluating and recommending on public safety issues. The Fuquay-Varina Board of Commissioners voted at its April 6th meeting to suspend the activity of its Public Safety Committee, a group of three commissioners tasked with hearing and recommending on public safety issues. The committee was resurrected a month earlier following a racist policing incident in January involving a black 14-year-old child wrongly accused of stealing a bike. At the meeting, the committee chair recommended that the town's citizen form their own group for ongoing discussion of relevant issues. The mayor pro tem cited the town's Money Geek ranking as the number one safest small town in North Carolina as a reason both to dismiss any issues raised regarding local policing and to disband the committee outright. Following suit, the mayor offered comments on the body camera footage from the January 2021 event, saying he felt proud of the young man who listened and did what he was supposed to do, and of the officer whose demeanor was respectful. The mayor's descriptions of the January incident footage are not entirely incorrect. It would be fair, for example, to say that the arresting officer proffered certain kindnesses. He appeared willing to adjust the boy's handcuffs so they hurt less, and he took some care to avoid injury to the child's head as he helped him into the back seat of the police car. What is perhaps less noticeable on the video is that the arresting officer's superior eventually arrives on the scene to question the very decision to handcuff the boy and to recommend that he be released from cuffs and car. Less noticeable still is that the arresting officer describes the boy as mouthing off when he attempts to establish that he has a legitimate bill of sale for the bike in question. Even less noticeable is that the boy has been handcuffed and put into the back of a police car in front of his own home, just feet away from where his father inside is not notified of his son's arrest until a good deal of time has passed. We'll get to that, the officer repeats when queried. As the mayor's comments focused on superficial markers of the interaction made clear, there is a version of racist policing that looks different from what we have become accustomed to seeing in the news in recent years. Regarding those familiar sights, we risk becoming inured to reports of the killing or abuse of black and brown people by police, so that when racist policing occurs that's not easily recognizable as extreme violence or murder, when there's no shouting, no weapon brandished, no bloodshed, many have a difficult time seeing it. A couple of months before the boy was arrested for a crime he did not commit, Fuquay-Varina police pulled over a young black couple in front of my home. At least two police vehicles were present. While the couple stood in the cold, the young man submitted to being searched, and both of them witnessed a tedious and thorough search of their entire vehicle, from under the front hood to the floor coverings to the trunk linings. One of the officers detaining them occasionally attempted polite chit-chat. Were they from Greensboro? Did they know of a restaurant there that he liked? After 90 minutes, they were released without a citation. The young woman later told me that the event I witnessed was the fourth time she and her partner had been pulled over within a single week of their holiday travels. No amount of pride in polite-seeming contact conduct should keep us from noticing the racist assumptions and power dynamics played out beneath the surface of civility in both these instances. Routine events like these hint at why it's been so devastating for some Fuquay-Varina residents to learn that just after the Public Safety Commission's third meeting, and the first at which the public was invited to comment on the work remaining for everyone to feel safe, the town's leaders boasted about its safety rating and suspended the committee tasked with listening to its residents' safety concerns. At the final committee meeting, several callers made a plea for more and ongoing dialogue to repair and build trust between the town's leadership and its citizens. Others requested greater overall transparency, a cultural assessment of the police department, as well as bias training for police personnel, funding for community safety initiatives addressing those directly influenced by systemic racism, and targeted attention to the ways in which issues like housing, education, and health care are further determinants of a public's safety. Reinstating and reconstituting the Public Safety Committee seems like the very least the mayor and the town's Board of Commissioners could do toward entertaining the input they claim to value. Whether they will prove capable of creating and sustaining an actual conversation regarding public safety or taking direct action on behalf of citizens who do not yet feel safe are matters that we should see addressed within a formally established municipal committee, rather than hear that these issues are best addressed by concerned citizens. And Lee Toss column, Road Rules. In 1999, before North Carolina Senator Jay Chaudhary was a politician, he was a law student at North Carolina Central University in Durham when he noticed the red and blue lights of a police cruiser light up behind him. Chaudhary, who is Indian American, pulled over his car and waited anxiously as a police officer approached him. His alleged infraction? Turning on his left turn signal too early. I was alarmed and shocked, Chaudhary said. I was completely unaware of his charge, and I had to challenge his reason for pulling me over. Chaudhary was lucky. He was a third-year law student who understood his rights and walked away without even a citation. But the incident didn't sit well with him. Nearly two decades later, a study would elaborate why. Driving while black was a very real phenomenon, especially in Durham. An analysis of 18 million traffic stops in North Carolina between 2002 and 2013 revealed young black men were pulled over, searched, and arrested far more than any other group, despite the fact that contraband was discovered less often among those drivers. Racial bias was driving the traffic stops, the study found. Even worse, the disparities in policing appeared to be getting worse over time. Chaudhary told the Indy, Dante Wright was pulled over because of a non-moving violation, and I think it raises a host of questions as to whether traffic stops are worth the cost or not. I think the evidence certainly suggests that it is not. Wright, a 20-year-old black man, was killed by a white police officer after he was pulled over for having expired registration tags. A struggle ensued, and the officer, Kim Potter, claims she thought she was deploying a taser when she fatally shot Wright. While police training and accountability are necessary to address the overuse of force by police, Chaudhary believes reworking policy and ramping up the state's data reporting could stop the problem at its source, the traffic stop. Last month, Chaudhary, along with Durham Senator Natalie Murdoch, filed a bill that would formally designate a racially profiled traffic stop a civil rights violation and aim to curtail the use of racial profiling through state-mandated studies and policy changes. Chaudhary says, that's the most common police-citizen interaction that takes place. When you overlay that with the disproportionate number of drivers who are people of color that are pulled over, it certainly increases the risk. Studies show that a fraction of traffic stops are really for the purpose of traffic safety. A traffic stop occurs either because there's a need to raise revenue, or a minor traffic stop is used as a pretext to investigating people for something completely unrelated to traffic safety. Most of the time, Chowdhury says, few traffic stops result in the public safety purpose. If the police were no longer allowed to pull over anyone for non-moving violations that don't threaten public safety, how many instances of police brutality could be avoided? Furthermore, what would happen if those resources were redirected toward public safety, pulling over only vehicles that posed a direct danger to the public? The answer to that experiment already played out in Fayetteville. Former Chief Harold Medlock gained national attention for dramatically changing the role of police within his community. After he was hired as chief in 2012, Medlock found a community distrustful of the police department and decided to take a new approach, partly motivated by his tenure overseeing Charlotte's traffic unit. He'd seen his fair share of death and destruction on the roadways from drunk drivers and speeding. Expired plates or tinted windows, on the contrary, weren't killing anyone. He told the Indy, I determined that we were going to stop making traffic stops based on regulatory or equipment violations. We were going to focus on the things that kept people alive and kept them from being injured. It was an unwritten policy, more a philosophy, but it worked. Over time, the result was not only fewer fatalities on the road, but the racial disparities in traffic stops began to lessen. Furthermore, with officers spending more time building relationships in neighborhoods rather than pulling over everything that moves, community trust began to rebuild. Chowdhury hoped that what was learned in Fayetteville could benefit the police departments throughout the state through increased data analysis and policy reformation. Unfortunately, like the majority of Democrat-sponsored bills in the North Carolina legislature, Chowdhury's bill was referred to the Rules Subcommittee, where it was not taken up before the crossover deadline, leaving it functionally extinct, unless a Republican chooses to take it back up. He'll likely refile the bill in 2 years in hopes that lawmakers can push it forward then. In the meantime, there's nothing stopping police departments and sheriffs from adopting their own internal policies to combat racial profiling. Medlock says, it has to be the leader's will. It has to be the leader of the agency who says, we need to take a hard look at who we are and what we're doing. Change is hard. It's hard to change, especially after you've been doing it one way for years, or even decades. Next, James Porter, A Mother's Mission, from Raleigh. The first time I met Rolanda Byrd was outside of a community meeting at the Bible Way Temple in southeast Raleigh following the fatal shooting of her son, 24-year-old Akil Denkins, by RPD Officer D.C. Twitty in February of 2016. It was a sunny day, but Byrd wore the mantle of the brokenhearted. Standing next to her younger son, Trayvon, she smiled weakly at media members, clergy, and neighbors as they streamed inside. Her eyes were lowered, her shoulders hunched. She seemed exhausted from the weight of grief. It would be easy for a parent who's lost a child in such a way to drown in a kind of all-consuming despair. That isn't to say that Byrd is not still angry or hurt, but she isn't consumed by bitterness or pain. Instead, Byrd has put a voice to the injustice that claimed Akil's life and today uses it to fight for police reform. A new two-part report from Frame, a digital magazine that publishes interactive documentaries on political and social issues from the perspectives of those affected, follows Byrd from her life with her family in Raleigh before Akil's death to the day of his shooting, his aftermath, and the work she's done since with the Raleigh Police Accountability Community Task Force, PACT, advocating for changes in the capital city's police department. Raleigh native Chelsea Bregini reported the short message service, SMS documentary, which uses local reports, social media posts, video footage, and interviews with Bird herself to tell an interactive story about police violence. It took Bird 5 months after Akhil's death, the documentary tells us, to work up the will to go speak before the Raleigh City Council for the first time. "I was so nervous," she said. "My gut hurt, like scared to even talk about myself or my son, and then just asking for change from them that first time." That day in July 2016, Bird told the council members who she was, who Akhil was. She asked the council to implement a body camera policy for officers. The documentary reveals that Bird believes she would know for certain which version of how her son was shot and killed, the officer's version or the one reported by neighbors, was true had Twitty been wearing a body camera. But it quickly became clear to Bird that the council wasn't going to engage. She said, "They went from my period at the end of my 3 minutes to the next person, without conversing with me, without responding to what I had just read to them, and then realizing after that first meeting that it was going to continue to be that way." Bird kept showing up to the council meetings with PACT and kept speaking out, even when new rules of decorum that council members instituted dictated how speakers were allowed and not allowed to address them. A jarring moment in the documentary highlights, absurdly, how disconnected some government bureaucrats and elected officials are from the victims of policing. Bird, again, spoke before the council to ask that officers wear body cameras and that the council create a police accountability oversight board. The council listened and then spent the next 20 minutes of the meeting talking with residents who wanted a pool in their community and needed a rezoning. Bird says they have these dialogues with these folks, but can't have a life or death conversation with these parents that come before them, with these sisters, brothers, family members, children who've lost their parents, come before them, and there's no conversation. It's dead silence. As executive director of PACT, Bird helped influence the city to finally adopt a body camera policy in early 2018. The policy was updated the next year following the shooting of Sohail Mojarrad, a 30-year-old man killed by an officer who was wearing a body camera but failed to activate it. Then last spring and summer, the George Floyd protests in downtown Raleigh took Bird's activism to a new level. More than 5,000 people converged downtown, and Trayvon, Akhil's younger brother, confronted officers with a blown-up photograph of Akhil. Raleigh City Council agreed to assemble a police oversight board. It was a symbolic gesture more than anything, as the board, due to state laws, doesn't actually have investigative or subpoena power or the authority to discipline officers. Still, PACT's membership grew last summer, and PACT and five other local social justice organizations formed the umbrella group Raleigh Demands Justice. Raleigh Demands Justice advocates for more police reform measures in a city where six people, four of them black, were shot and killed by police between 2013 and 2020, and where 58% of drivers pulled over are black versus 20% who were white, despite black people comprising less than a third of the city's overall population. In a scene at the end of the first part of that documentary, Bird stands outside a corner store on Bragg Street, near where Akhil was killed, and describes how she came to realize her new mission in the wake of her son's death. She says, "I started to understand that my purpose now, because of what happened to my son, was to be that voice for our community, to be that mother that can stand up and fight for other mothers, because of what's happening to our family members. Our story means so much to the people in our communities. This is our hood. This is our city. And one way or another, we're going to take it back." Well, from Tomasi McDonald, harsh punishments. In March, State Representative John Torbett, a Republican from Gaston, sponsored House Bill 247. Which would open the door to stiffer penalties for public school students who commit classroom infractions. The bill is counterintuitive during a period when youth advocates are calling for restorative justice measures to reduce students' contact with the criminal justice system, yet the bill passed the House on a 66-49 vote without any Democratic support and is awaiting action in the Senate. An analysis of the bill by the General Assembly's Legislative Analysis Division determined the legislation would, among other things, require school boards to consult with local law enforcement agencies, along with teachers, administrators, and parents, when adopting student conduct policies. But, more important, the bill would allow four types of school infractions to be punishable by stiffer penalties, including long-term suspension. These include inappropriate language, non-compliance, dress code violations, and minor physical altercations. Critics say that if the bill is signed into law, it will disproportionately impact black and brown students, who already account for a disparate rate of school complaints, and any increase in suspensions could exacerbate both dropout rates and the school-to-prison pipeline. Tyler Wittenberg, chief counsel for the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, said in a press release last week, "These are all minor, vague, and subjective infractions that will be used to disproportionately place black and Latinx students on long-term suspension, disrupting their education while fueling the school-to-prison pipeline." He pointed to the SCSJ's annual racial equity report cards that show black and Latinx students are already more likely to be suspended than their white classmates are. Quote, "Part of making sure these students are safe from racial bias and discrimination begins with keeping safeguards in place that minimize the likelihood of inequitable treatment. Long-term suspensions, especially for minor infractions like those outlined in HB 247, delay and undermine the process of identifying and addressing the root cause of legitimate behavioral issues while placing an unreasonable burden on working families. This is a step in the wrong direction for a state where most people would rather walk toward equity." Torbett, the bill's sponsor, did not respond to interview requests last week from the Indy. Durham County School Board member Natalie Bayer told the Indy that she shares the concerns expressed by the SCSJ regarding the bill. Quote, as she quoted in an email to the Indy, "At a time of growing concerns about disproportionalities in school discipline nationally, it's imperative to be transparent about these disparities and bring school and community leaders together to eliminate the school-to-prison pipeline. Progressive school districts in North Carolina are revising policies to focus on restorative practices and equity as we work to make improvements. HB 247 is not a reflection of those best practices." She added she is also concerned about the proposed requirement to involve law enforcement officers in setting school discipline policies because, in some districts, young people are criminalized by school resource officers. The on-campus presence of school resource officers, SRO, from the sheriff's office, contracted by Durham Public Schools, was a major concern for members of the Youth Justice Project, YJP, a student-led initiative to implement change in the county school system. As previously reported by Indy during the George Floyd protests in Durham last summer, YJP members say that a central part of their mission is to dismantle the school-to-prison pipeline. The presence of SROs on public school campuses, the student activists say, increases the likelihood of students ending up in juvenile court and students under the age of 18 being charged as adults for classroom altercations. Former YJP member Aisha Deering wrote a petition letter last summer that circulated on social media and was forwarded to the county board school board members. In the letter, Deering said school funding for SROs would be put to better use by hiring, quote, more school psychologists, more guidance counselors, school nurses, therapists, and substance abuse specialists instead of members of law enforcement to create a safe school climate. Deering added that the school system, quote, should have more appropriate disciplinary techniques that include restorative practice centers that are more equipped to handle any school issues than any intervention from law enforcement. In extreme situations, it is then that schools should ask for peacekeeping intervention. The SCSI report, the SCSJ report made public in March found nearly 30% of juvenile court referrals statewide came from schools in 2019 and 2020. The report also found that 49% of all juvenile complaints were filed against black students, even though they make up a quarter of the North Carolina public school population. The report notes that criminalization of youthful misbehavior has immediate and long-term consequences. The report's authors point to studies that show young people who come into contact with the criminal justice system are more likely to commit other crimes and become ensnared and hobbled by the criminal system for the rest of their lives. The authors also note another grim reality. A child's involvement with the court system will likely impede their access to quality of life benefits, including education, employment, housing, public benefits, and voting rights, along with other sources of opportunity and support. Durham County School Board member Frederick Raven III wondered why the bill was written in such a divisive manner and asked what was the goal of the proposed legislation. He asked in an email to Indy, "Is there a goal and intentionality behind splitting communities apart? Is there a goal to figure another way to increase the amount of damage inflicted upon communities by expanding the school-to-prison pipeline system?" He added, quote, "These types of bills would make more sense if the change agents admitted that their goal is to sabotage the work and efforts that communities invest in by improving living conditions and quality of life standards overall." Now, Melba Newsom pens this article, reprinted in Indy Week, originally from the North Carolina Health News, which is a statewide news organization dedicated to covering all things healthcare in North Carolina, and is titled "The Long Haul." One day in late April, Prudential Springs took longer than usual getting ready for her job transporting seniors for the nonprofit PACE of the Southern Piedmont. Lately, it's been little things that get her tangled up. Where she put her keys? Had she made her lunch? What was her first stop? Prior to this job, Springs had worked in transportation for the Charlotte Housing Authority because she enjoyed helping seniors. But after being out with COVID for 2 months, Springs returns to work with the residents, some of whom have dementia. That's a reminder of her own struggles with confusion and forgetting. She says, she's 62 years old, and she says, "Today I took some medication to a lady's house and forgot she was supposed to sign the paper, so I had to go back. It should have been one trip, but it ended up being two. My memory is just like a person with dementia. It's like I'm falling into dementia. I have a grandson who will be turning 14. I want to make sure that I remember him. I worry about forgetting him." Experiences like Springs have become alarmingly common among COVID survivors. According to a study published in the Annals of Clinical and Translational Neurology, even after the acute infection cleared, an overwhelming number of people who contracted the virus but were never hospitalized report a string of neurological problems, including brain fog, fatigue, dizziness, headaches, numbness, and tingling. Brain fog is the most common. Commonly called post-COVID syndrome or long COVID, this condition was only recently dubbed post-acute sequelae of SARS-CoV infection, or PASC, by the National Institutes of Health. Experts are still working to define it. Some consider patients to have the syndrome if they remain symptomatic 4 to 6 weeks after their initial infection resolves. Others say 12 weeks. The seriousness of SARS-CoV-2 has been discounted among some because of what they say is a relatively low mortality rate. even as that death rate is actually orders of magnitude higher than for seasonal flu. Now, there is increasing evidence of people who had less severe cases of COVID being waylaid by this lingering, life-changing disease up to a year later. A study published by researchers from the University of Washington suggests 10 to 30% of COVID patients have one or more symptoms of long COVID, including intense fatigue, chest pain, brain fog, shortness of breath, loss of taste and smell are most common. Spring's most persistent complaints are brain fog and shortness of breath. That means that in the United States, where there are more than 32 million cases of COVID-19, as many as 9.6 million people may still be experiencing long-haul symptoms after they no longer test positive for the virus. In North Carolina, blacks account for approximately 175,000 of the total coronavirus cases. If 30% of those survivors become long haulers, that would have a deep and lasting impact on the physical, emotional, and economic health of the community, a population that has less access to health insurance, care, and treatment than whites. Researchers are still exploring what's behind this mysterious disease. One theory says symptoms are due to the damage caused by the infection and subsequent inflammatory response. Because long haulers exhibit a variety of different symptoms, doctors, hospitals, and researchers are challenged to find the best way forward. John Barata, co-director of UNC COVID Recovery Clinic, says, "We don't have a lot of specific scientific answers because it's just all so new. Through research, that's what we and others have to figure out. Hopefully, as time goes on, science will catch up and we'll have more to offer." Springs noticed her first COVID symptoms in early November. She said, "I didn't run a fever, but I struggled to breathe. Trying to go upstairs was a job. It really took a toll on me. Even just trying to get out of bed and walk was really hard. I couldn't sleep, or I slept at odd times." 2 days later, Springs tested positive. She said, "I cried. I had my asthma under control for 15 years, and I was trying my best not to get COVID because I knew it was going to be hard on me. I tried my best to keep myself well, keep myself protected." She knew that working with a vulnerable, high-risk population also put her at risk. Nonetheless, she was shocked when she got sick. "I played it over and over again in my head and kept trying to figure it out because it just didn't make any sense. But you work with the elderly and they have family members come and visit them." Fearing she may have blood clots and because she lived alone, Spring's doctor pushed her to go into the hospital, but she resisted being admitted because her family wouldn't be able to see her. Instead, she made 2 trips to the emergency room for oxygen. The scans showed her lungs looking like ground glass, a radiologic finding that has become a diagnostic marker of COVID infection. Having lost 2 family members, an uncle in Charlotte and a cousin in Lancaster, South Carolina, to the disease, Springs can't understand the laissez-faire attitude many still have about COVID. Even after the devastating effect of the virus on the black community, there are still black people who think it's no big deal, she said. For doctors looking to treat the long-term effects of the disease, it feels like they're back in the early days of the pandemic, learning what works as they go. Despite the staggering numbers, there's no clear way to diagnose long COVID and no standard treatment protocol. Some long haulers feel better after a couple of weeks following the initial infection, but then fall ill to old or even new disease-related symptoms that may affect multiple organs and systems weeks or months later. For others like Springs, their symptoms never fully abate after the initial infection. They just linger. PASC is sometimes compared with misunderstood ailments such as chronic fatigue syndrome. Similar to those patients, many long haulers struggle to have their symptoms recognized and taken seriously. Sometimes clinicians take a full medical history and assess all COVID-19 symptoms from the beginning of the infection. They may also run a battery of tests to rule out any other possible causes of the symptoms. Post-COVID clinics like the one at UNC are springing up around the country to address these aftercare issues. These clinics typically take a multidisciplinary approach to caring for the myriad problems that can plague survivors. Pulmonologists treat lung and breathing issues. Cardiologists are on board to handle heart problems. Social workers, mental health professionals weigh in on the best way to address mental health problems. After nearly 8 weeks, Springs no longer tested positive for the virus. She returned to work in early January, already knowing that there's a difference between no longer being infected and being recovered. She struggled to do the things that had once been easier for her. She says, "I didn't know where I'm going. I was in the house for so long, I didn't know how to drive. I had to get comfortable with driving again. When it came to the people that I knew so well, I knew their faces, but I couldn't remember their names until somebody said it." Springs says her pulmonologist told her that it would take 6 months before she got completely better. She's into her 7th month and still struggling to breathe. She pauses and sobs softly. "Now, coming up and down the stairs is hard, even after doing the inhalers. Sometimes I think maybe I'm being impatient, but it's taking too long for me to get it together. I have to get it together." Nobody really knows how long that will take. Next, our feature from Jeff West, seeking compensation. On the grounds of an affordable housing complex in Kinston, Howard Dudley finds peace sitting on a swing early in the morning, watching the sunrise. Gone are the late-night hollers of convicts who kept him awake, the commands of guards, and the shudder of prison bars. Sometimes he calls his sister and tells her how good the air feels. His sister Linda Hawkins says, "Things we take for granted." After nearly 24 years in prison, Dudley, now 64, was exonerated and released in 2016 for a crime he didn't commit. The senior living facility is a place for Dudley to rest his head because it's all he can afford. His family hopes it's temporary. After waiting more than 2 decades to win his freedom, he's now waiting for justice. 36 states award compensation to those wrongfully imprisoned, generally on a sliding scale, depending on time served. In North Carolina, an exonerated person is entitled to $50,000 for each year spent in prison, up to a maximum of $750,000. Dudley is entitled to the full amount, but there's a snag. North Carolina is one of only 4 states that require an official pardon of innocence from the governor, little more than a stroke of a pen, before an exoneree can apply for compensation, an extra step that can delay the process for years. Maryland, one of the 4 states, recently passed legislation that removed the step. In North Carolina, meanwhile, a bipartisan House bill sought to do the same. The bill would provide an alternate route for exonerees to qualify for compensation by allowing a court to determine whether the vacated conviction was erroneous, a ruling to mean that no reasonable juror would have found the person guilty. The governor could still issue a pardon to provide for compensation. House Majority Whip John Hardister, a Republican from Guilford County, says he sponsored the bill in recognition of the impact that being falsely convicted can have on a person's financial stability and the notoriously long wait exonerees face in seeking their just compensation. He criticized both the process as well as Governor Roy Cooper's history of issuing pardons during his tenure. He said in an email, The current process is cumbersome, and it can take many years for an exonerated person to receive their due compensation for the state. For whatever reason, the current governor seems to be taking an inordinate amount of time to issue pardons for people who have been exonerated, which has placed many people and their families in a very difficult situation. This bill seeks to streamline the process so that courts can effectuate the process of vacating the sentences of a person who is exonerated and allow that person to seek restitution without waiting for gubernatorial action. The bill was introduced late in the session, however, too late to meet the so-called crossover deadline of May 13th, when legislation passed in one chamber must be sent over for the other chamber to consider. But Hardister said the legislation isn't necessarily dead. It's possible it could be introduced as an amendment to another bill. Representative Marcia Morey, a Democrat from Durham and co-sponsor of the bill, agreed the current process needs reforming. Quote, no amount of money can buy back the lost, painful years of incarceration, but legislation should be enacted that affords swift compensation to the wrongfully convicted. In an email to the Indy, Dory McMillan, a spokesperson for Cooper's office, noted the governor has issued six pardons, but ignored related questions, including whether the governor supported the bill and why Cooper waited nearly 4 years in office to issue his first pardons to exonerees. Dudley's petition, McMillan said without elaborating, is under review by the clemency office. Duke Law professor Jamie Lau represented Dudley in his appeal as part of Duke Law's Wrongful Convictions Clinic, which advocates on behalf of those wrongfully imprisoned. Lau says the process of requiring a pardon to qualify for compensation needs reforming. Under the current system, an exoneree can seek a pardon by applying through the governor's clemency office, which reviews petitions and provides recommendations to the governor. But Lau says the process is opaque. A page on the clemency office's website designed to show pending applications, for instance, hasn't been updated since Cooper took office. He says, quote, it's really a black box. Once the request you made, you don't know anything about what's happening or where it stands. That's the case for Dudley, who was convicted in 1992 of, excuse me, I'll read that when I can turn the page. The case for Dudley, convicted in 1992 of sexually assaulting his 9-year-old daughter based solely on her account to police. She later recanted her story. Dudley's application for pardon went to the governor's office shortly after his release, where it's lingered without resolution for 5 years. And Dudley's not alone. Lau says, I know of 5 people who have pending requests in front of the governor. I can't tell you if there's more because those are just the people I personally know have made requests. Lau said former governor Pat McCrory acted with quite a bit of speed in granting pardons, particularly in the case of Lamonte Armstrong, who was exonerated in March 2013 and by December had received a pardon that provided compensation. Lau says, in comparison, the prior administration was much better at making these decisions and making them in a timely fashion to actually help someone coming out of a long-term incarceration who really needs some assistance and help with their immediate needs. Cooper, meanwhile, went nearly his entire first term without any acts of clemency. In December, he finally granted pardons to 5 people, including Ronnie Long, one of Lau's clients. Long was exonerated in August of 2020 and received his pardon in December, but his case was unique. Lau says, there was a huge push for that act to be taken in Ronnie Long's case. It shouldn't take moving mountains to get these quick decisions. The 4 other men pardoned last December waited longer. Quote, those people had been exonerated for 5 years and had their requests pending for years without any action, and had no idea whether or not they would ever receive a pardon of innocence. Cooper recently pardoned Daryl Howard, but again he had waited nearly 5 years before receiving the pardon that allowed for compensation. Lau says, the fact is, these men need the money as soon as they come out. And he points to the case of Charles Finch, who was exonerated after 43 years in prison. Quote, "We pushed him out of a prison in a wheelchair at 80 years old, but he still not received a dime from the state for those 43 years of wrongful incarceration." The governor, whose pardons could be held against him during a re-election bid, shouldn't be the gatekeeper, Lau says. "It's too political a process to have the governor as the gatekeeper when an impartial court could trigger the compensation itself in an open hearing with a transparent review of all the evidence in the case." The two-bedroom apartment on the ninth floor of the Kinston Towers is basic, nothing flashy about it, Hawkins, Dudley's sister, says, "just a place where he can lay his head until he can do better. And that's his dream," she says. On the advice of Dudley's attorney, with a police misconduct lawsuit pending, Hawkins spoke on her brother's behalf. She says when he went in, he was a young, vibrant man who held down a job. He had a wife. He had a relationship with his kids. Now his children are grown, and his wife died before his release, his mother, too. A monthly Social Security check, which covers Dudley's rent and a little food, goes only so far, his sister said. He has to stretch that money the whole month. Dudley talks about owning a home, a yard, something peaceful, something he had been working for before his life was ripped away from him. But her brother still has hope, Hawkins says. Quote, "He should be compensated for the life that he wanted before they locked him up. He wanted to work. He wanted to retire. He wanted to raise his kids and do things like normal people do. And they took this away from him." Time, I believe, for a music article by Ryan Coca, Higher Frequencies. This is about a hip-hop producer, Crysis, K-H-R-Y-S-A-S. In his home studio in Raleigh, flanked by keyboards and turntables, the music producer and recording engineer Crysis is shaking his head in disbelief. "This is dope. This is really dope," like he trails off, taking a long pause. "I had a hard time imagining that I'd get something like this." We're nearing the end of our second conversation in as many weeks, and a new EP from the Raleigh-based rap group Coolie High, mixed entirely by him, has just been released. A song by Buffalo, New York rapper Conway the Machine, titled Jesus Crisis, a nod to his producer, is also nearing 2 million hits on YouTube and, most important, The Hour of Crisis, the artist's fifth album, chock full of guest features from Busta Rhymes to De La Soul and inspired by the albums of old-school soul-chopping masters like J Dilla and Pete Rock, is just 2 weeks old. But by this, Crisis doesn't mean any of that. He means this, as in this article. It's hard to blame him. For casual hip-hop listeners over the past 20 years, Crisis 39 hasn't been a name you've seen so much as a sound you've heard. The unheralded jack-of-all-trades behind the boards for everyone from Little Brother and Rhapsody to Black Thought and Talib Kweli. But if being one of the most perennial slept-on producers in hip-hop is weighing on him, it doesn't show. He says, "My name might not be in the marquee, but it's in the credits." It's a fitting analogy for a career defined by the relationship below the surface and by the twists of fate that have kept one opportunity leading to the next for nearly two decades. He has his own word for these twists of fate, he says. "We all move at our own frequencies. A lot of times, frequencies match. When you do the work, eventually somebody's going to notice." For Crisis, the frequencies started matching in the fall of 2001. Back home and living with his parents in Durham after dropping out of Winston-Salem State University, he was listening to the Duke student radio station, WXDU 88.7, when the DJ's voice caught his attention. This was Patrick Dothit, a former North Carolina Central University student he'd bumped into years before and exchanged music production tips with. Tyson called the station and said he was back in Durham and making beats. Dothit invited him to come out by Missy Ann, the studio he was working out of at the time. What Dothit, or Ninth Wonder, was working on an album with the rappers Font and the rapper Big Pooh under the group name Little Brother, would eventually release in 2003 as The Listening. The album would become an early internet underground hip-hop sensation, launching not only the careers of its core members, but also of the entire Justice League collective that surrounded it. Before long, Crisis was officially voted onto the crew's sprawling ranks. He says, "I had blinders on." He was soon producing for not only for Justice League acts, but also underground veterans like Brooklyn MC's Sean Price and Master Ace. "I had a lot to do." When the Justice League splintered just a few years later, he became a staple of Ninth Wonder's Jamla Records, handling much of the in-house recording, mixing, and engineering at the nascent level, at the nascent label, a place where he would find community and help catapult careers. "That was the first time I had record labels reaching out to me." "We just clicked," said Raleigh rapper-producer Mez, who in 2010 as a teenager spent countless nights in the Jamla studio. The following year, the pair released a six-track EP, The King's Crisis, creating some of the earliest buzz. Mez has since gone on to work with J. Cole, Dr. Dre, and Kanye West. Within Jamla, Crisis would play a similarly invaluable role in the asset of the ascent of the label's flagship artist, Rhapsody. And I'll have to abridge this article. It ends by saying, "After a career spent living in the liner notes, he seems to be enjoying, at least momentarily, seeing his name in the marquee. As he enters his third decade in the music industry, he isn't taking the moment for granted." He says, "I feel like I've finally arrived." And as our musicians crank up again, I have to close this broadcast of the Indie Week. And it will be on the North Carolina Reading Service website, ncreadingservice.org, in the podcast section for the entire week. There are some articles I see online, for example, the ballots for all the Best of the Triangle series are apparently going to be voted on fairly soon. You'll probably find ballots or things like that online if you're interested in voting for some of these places. They cover everything. Hopefully we'll have time to read some of those in a week or two. So John Fetterson bids you a fond farewell from Indie Week.